going to use the overhead projector and color maps again. This is one of the maps that we had up there last week, in which from 700 to 900 AD, it showed how that God allowed the Mohammedans, the Muslims, to conquer all this territory that's colored in green. Now, we know that Christianity of some sort prevailed all the way across North Africa a few years before that. We know that there were those who allied with the Catholic Church that was in a process of formation, and we know that there were a group of dissenters who did not fellowship with them. In fact, they rebaptized all the Catholics that they took into their churches, called the Donatists, that for several centuries before the Muslim takeover were all along the coast of Africa from about there over to at least there. Why did God allow the darkness of the Mohammedan religion to engulf all that area? Well, I don't know that I can answer that question, but I do know that I'm told that Muhammad himself, that began here in Arabia, that Christianity was in a very sad shape at that time, and that he took a mixture of Jewish, pagan, and Christian beliefs and made something that, as you know today, a great number of people in this world are in darkness because of their adherence to it. As these people came up through Spain and conquered all but just a little bit of it, in the 700s they tried to conquer all of Western Europe. Charles Martel, Charles the Hammer, I think is the grandfather of Charlemagne, was a Frankish king. At the time, he turned them back right near Paris at the city of Tours, if that's the way the French pronounce it. I don't know, I never can pronounce French word, but T-O-U-R-S. Drove them back into Spain, which they ruled a good part of Spain for 700 years. Well, you notice they had a little conquest there on the southern coast of France, too. All of these Mediterranean islands, the boot heel of Italy, and had taken a little bit of what is now Turkey. Right here is where the Lord stopped them, and right here I intend to try to show you was the place where churches existed through the darkest of ages. Most of the people lived in the river valleys or close to the sea coast. The world population wasn't that great. These people went up into the high valleys between the Alpine mountains and there created a very prosperous place for themselves. And they were very well thought of by the lords of the land in most cases, except those who were fanatical against their religion. So for several centuries, I don't believe anybody paid very much attention to them. And they were dwelling in that area right there between, which is, I'll show you in a later map, that's right on the border between what is now France and Italy. Not very far, in fact, from the Mediterranean Sea. I made mention about some of the lineages that have been worked out. Some of you have seen those for some of our churches that go all the way supposedly back to the Apostles' Day. And I showed you last week, might have disillusioned some, that one man that we always find was the Montanus Tertullian, concluded in that lineage, and that he would not be recognized as a sound Baptist today, in spite of the evidence that he was a saved man. But he's always included in that lineage, which to me casts a great doubt upon that lineage as far as it being a record of sound churches. So what good is it? Well, it's one of those jewels to me of history, nevertheless, because what it does do is show us that you can get back through the ages without going through the Catholic Church. It shows us that you can go through dissenting preachers and churches, and if you can do it once, you could probably do it 100 times if you had enough records. Someone, and once upon a time, I saw that lineage written out all the way down to this country with the documentation of where all of those references came from. I never did check them out, but I'd like to, but somehow or other I don't remember where it was that I saw that. Now, in that, I said that to say this, as Eugene Brown would say, you'll find, I think, two instances, if I remember correctly, where someone came from here, from Asia Minor, which is over in here, didn't say where, to the Piedmont Valleys that we're talking about. And on another occasion, there was a preacher, now we're talking about two links in that lineage, went from here back over into here. What does that tell us? It tells us that those people knew about each other. It tells us that when someone tries to tell us, well, the Paulicians came from Asia Minor, actually I think they began here in Armenia, and over into here where they were called Bogomiles hundreds of years later, and then on across northern Italy, where they met up with the Waldenses that we're talking about, and then they went on over into southern France, where they were called Albigenses or Albigenses, after the French city of Albi. They were discovered there in about 1100 and made public by the Catholic powers, and they began to try to exterminate them. Both the Waldenses in France and the Albigenses were the targets of several crusades. More crusades were called, they might not have been as grand, but more crusades were called against those dissenting Christians than were ever called against the Muslims. That's something you don't get out of your history book. The Catholic lords of this region in the 1200s would have saved these people from extermination and put their lives and their fortunes on the line to do so because they were good people. They would have done that had it not been for the Pope calling crusade after crusade after crusade and essentially promising these crusaders a free ticket to heaven if they would just go spend 40 days helping to exterminate these people. Now, maybe getting a little ahead of myself, but then in 987 or some such year, before the year 1000, in that same lineage, there was a man who went from the Piedmont Valleys to England to a church called Hill Cliff. Now, whether that's the same Hill Cliff that appeared later as a Baptist church is hard to say. Might not even have been the same church of the same beliefs. But what does it tell us? It tells us long before that Wycliffe had his rebellion against the Catholic Church in the 1300s, a very successful rebellion. John Wycliffe, or Wycliffe, was a very successful Protestant in the 1300s and essentially threw out a greater part of the false doctrine that was in the Catholic Church, at least for his followers, which were called Lollards. It shows you that there was influence coming from the continent and from these valleys into that area long before that Wycliffe ever had his rise in rebellion against the Catholic Church. So those are just little gems to me that you can pick up if you know what to do with them that prove something about how prevalent, or not prevalent, but how real the existence of a certain amount of true religion was in periods when the powers that be say that it didn't exist. One question you can always ask people, you say, well, there weren't any churches that believed like you Baptists back in that era. Say, well, who then were they persecuting? Well, you know, they'll tell you that these Albigenses had some very wildly heretical beliefs. But from what I'm able to tell, this is a slander, that these people were probably at least in fellowship with the Waldenses, and so they were not far removed from them in belief, if they were removed any at all. I'm going to show you next time, hopefully, some quotes from some actual documents that were salvaged from the 1100 period that was preserved from the Italian Waldenses and brought out of that area and translated into English in the 1500s during the period that Oliver Cromwell ruled England. They were in the process at that time of exterminating what was left of those people. They had already united with the Reformation. And so the Puritans in England, along with the rest of the Calvinistic type Protestants, were very much inclined to try to help them. And so Cromwell intervened, or tried to intervene, to stop their destruction. That wasn't the first time there was an effort to exterminate these people. They were exterminated from southern France during the 1200s. Okay, I believe that this is strong evidence that the Lord recognized these as his precious bride. He stopped the Muslims there. And there must have been some reason why that he did that. This is about the year 1000. I'm going to get some things from this map. Muslims were still in control of this part of Spain. They had been driven out of the northernmost part of it. They were certainly driven out of France. Western Europe had been taken over by the Germans, various tribes of Germans, Vandals, Goths, Franks, Lombards, had taken over what is now France. It was part of the old Roman Empire, the province of Gaul. And the Germans, before they conquered not only that, but they pushed down into Italy, conquered all of Spain and all of North Africa at one point in time, had been converted to Arian Christianity, which means that they were Unitarians. They didn't believe that Jesus was divine. So they were Christians in name. Robinson makes a special point. Benedict tells me that he was a Baptist in his history of pointing out the audacity of the Catholic Church to make the claim that they were the one and only universal church of Jesus Christ at a time when the Arians outnumbered them. And of course, that's not counting the dissenting groups that we would claim dissent from, who were Orthodox Trinitarians like we are, believing the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are all equal. Now, the Catholics do believe or profess that, and I think they believe it in their minds, and we do too, and it's true. But very soon, the Frankish kings were converted to the Orthodox faith, that is, to the Catholic faith. And one of these kings, by the name of Charlemagne, that you read about in history, managed to subdue all of this area for a while. And he thought it would be a grand idea somewhere around the year 800, if I remember correctly, if he, since he had all this territory under him and he was a good Catholic, if the Western Roman Empire, which had been in disarray ever since the Germans had created so much havoc, and all that was left of the empire was actually over here in the east, ruled from Constantinople. It'd be a great idea if he reestablished what he called the Holy Roman Empire. So right here, we'll see on the next map, is where that was done. And I put this particular map up there because this was the Kingdom of Burgundy. It's one you probably hadn't heard of. Another thing you may find astonishing is some of these areas like Italy. Italy was not a single country until somewhere in the 1800s. Italy was an area made up of numerous kingdoms. Burgundy included the area where these valleys were. And that was probably a good fortune because it enabled them to be ruled by some local lords who didn't necessarily pay attention to the Pope and the Catholic lords to destroy these people. Now let's go on to the next map. If I look at my arrows, I'd get them right, maybe, first time. I don't have one on that one. Okay, this is Europe about 1200 A.D. Now you see what's happened. The Holy Roman Empire includes all of this at this point. Now they have got these poor folks surrounded. A good part of France was also very Catholic, as was England. Up until shortly before the Reformation, England was a very Catholic nation. At least the ruling Normans were. If you remember correctly, in the 1000 to 1100 era, the Duke of Normandy, one of his sons, went over here and conquered England and became its ruler. The Normans were descendants of Scandinavian people who had settled on the north coast of France and mixed in with the people there and ruled them. And they had conquered England, and for a long time they ruled parts of what is now France. As you see this shaded blue area, that's what that is. In 1209, I believe it was, Pope Innocent III ordered the extermination of all these good people across the south of France. The Earl of Toulouse in France lost his dominions fighting against the Pope's crusaders, and Simon de Montfort, the English general that took this crusade up, the King of Aragon, Alfonso, forfeited his life in battle fighting for these people. There were three or four more lords that lost most of what they had because they were good men and they were defending these good people who historians to this day, and that's why I'm telling you this, will say, well, they were really vile heretics. Well, then why did Alfonso give his life to defend them? Why did Raymond, Earl of Toulouse, why did he forfeit his kingdom or his dominions in defending these people? Why did these other men do likewise? I mean, it has to be a slander. It cannot be true. And if you read the history closely, you will find that some of these men who were engaged in persecuting these people and also in slandering them, they said some things about them that nobody would believe. I mean, such outrageous, I'm glad they did that. Some outrageous, absurd accusations. One of them said their children were born with four rows of teeth and hair all over their face or some such thing like that. And of course, this would appeal to a lot of illiterate, superstitious, Catholic peasants that believed in werewolves and Dracula types. I can't think now what they call them. Yeah. But they had, you know, the people themselves would never have stood for what this extermination of this people had they not been some kind of accusation to show how vile they were. But this was a very bad time. They did actually wipe them out in this area, in southern France. They did not get rid of them over across the border here. This is now in Italy. For a long time it was a separate country. Now, they scattered just like seed thrown in a high wind. Northward, some of them landed as far over as in England, but Bohemia right here was a seemingly favorite gathering place for these people. And if I were asked where were our people the most abundant in the 1300s, I would say the hill country of Bohemia. Now, you say, well, what books did that come from? Well, you need to look in several to find that, but I could give you some references. Some few years ago, my son, Todd, who you're well familiar with, called me up on the telephone, and he was very excited. He'd found something in a secular history. And there's another one of these jewels I've been telling you about. He said, Dad, where would you say was the center of the true churches in 1348? And I said, well, son, I would say probably in Bohemia. He said, that's what I thought. He said, let me read you something. That was about the year that the bubonic plague, came from Asia. And some cities of Europe, 75% of the people died when the plague hit them. In all of Europe, they say a fourth of the people in all of the continent of Europe died of the bubonic plague in just a matter of a few years. There were so many dead people, they couldn't bury them. And people were too sick to bury them. And the people who did usually got the plague and also died in a short while. And it says there was no place in Europe exempt from this dreadful plague except one strange pocket of immunity in Bohemia. What do you think? I know what I thought. I know what Todd thought about it. It's another one of those things that tell me from the secular history book, they didn't understand why that those people in Bohemia, they didn't say where in Bohemia, had that strange pocket of immunity to the bubonic plague. Well, this was at the period in which our church has probably come the nearest to being exterminated. And maybe God had his reasons for sending the bubonic plague into Europe. But there were some people who were immune, and I think I know who some of them were. Now, as evidence of what happened here, a few years later, latter part of the 1300s, Bohemia became almost non-Catholic. John Huss and Jerome of Prague and others, two great leaders who had been Catholics. Of course, the historians will say, well, they read the works of Wycliffe. Yes, that they did. I suspect there was a pretty good intercourse between Bohemia and England, where the Lollards were that followed Wycliffe. You see, people back then were aware of one another, people who believed the truth. I wish we were that way today. And so, yes, Huss did read the writings of Wycliffe, his predecessor, but there were also thousands of these Waldensian people living up in the mountains all around John Huss's territory. And what happens when you have a seed of people who might be considered sound Baptist that are very zealous, that settle in the midst of a bunch of superstitious Catholics? What happens? They don't keep their mouth shut, do they? They're very careful who they talk to. We have some scripture, or some history that shows us how careful these men were. They were led of the Spirit. See, that's what we need to be. You're not so likely to approach somebody that'll cut your head off if you're led of the Spirit. Most of the persecution that took place against people in these darkened ages were because, not because they made a mistake of casting the pearls before the swine, but because they were so successful in converting the population, the numbers were so great that the lords of the land were upset about it. And brothers and sisters, I'll take persecution if we can do that first. It'd be worth it. What I don't want is persecution that comes, from our casting our pearls before swine. And so a greater part of the Bohemians became Protestants. Now, this is the late 1300s. This is how many years before the so-called Reformation, which was a Reformation, and I'm thankful for it. But Martin Luther hadn't been born at that time, was yet 100 and, or so years in the future. And the Catholics decided they would stop this. They lured two of the great leaders, Protestant leaders, into France under a promise of safe conduct, and then betrayed them, tried them for heresy, and burned them alive at the stake. Well, this, needless to say, infuriated some of the Catholics that remained in Bohemia who had not been used to taking up arms and fighting. But there was one, John de Trattenau, who was nicknamed Ziska because he just had one eye. He'd had enough of this. And he was one of the leaders of the Taborites, which was the most, I'd say, Baptistic group of Protestants that we're talking about. He organized an army, and he fought 11 campaigns against the Catholic lords and never lost a battle. And the last one or two, he was lost the other eye, and he was totally blind. Ziska said, before he died, he said, "When I die, I want you to skin me and make a drum out of my skin, so that whenever you beat that drum, it will strike fear and terror into the Catholic lords." Well, I don't think they did that, but you see, they had become very militant. I'm told that many of the Waldenses joined the Taborites for a period of time, and that after they became victorious, some of them began to go back and pick up some unsound practices. At that time, they decided they'd made a mistake, so they went back to their mountain brethren, and they didn't want to receive them back because they had left and joined a sect that was less than sound. Now, during the 1400s, I just got this, since I last taught a history lesson on this subject, I got this little gem. In the 1400s, there were three men who traveled all the way from Thessaly in Greece. This is the region around Thessalonica that you read about in the Bible. They traveled into Bohemia, and they encountered some of these Taborites. And they said, "We have heard in Thessaly that there are churches in Bohemia who believe like we do, and we're interested in examining your beliefs and practices." They were very disappointed because these people had started to revert back and adopt some of the Catholic ways. Now, you all know that a Protestant church is just somewhat of a mixture between Baptist and Catholic, don't you? They were disappointed. Well, someone said, "I think maybe that you might had better go up and talk to the Waldensian people up in the mountains. You might find them more to your liking." So they did, and they rejoiced to find out that they agreed on almost everything. Now, that's a remarkable thing. They said, "We have had sound churches in Thessaly all the way from the days of the apostles until now." I never heard that before until I read that just a short time ago. That doesn't surprise me. However it may prove out, this is the same story that Brother Paul Bryson has heard from a group of people here in the Carpathian Mountains in northern Romania on the borders of Ukraine and Russia. As far as they know, they've been there ever since the days of the apostles, and they believe essentially what we believe. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. I do know this, that whenever these people were scattered all across Europe, some of them traveled on into Poland. Nowhere could they escape persecution. Some of them went on into Hungary and points further east. There was a real tendency for some of them to adopt a Unitarian belief as they did that. I'm not sure I know why. You hear, if you read of Socinianism or Davidianism, those are lesser and lesser emphasis upon the greatness of Jesus. Later on, many of these over in here that had already given up the idea that Jesus was divine, in fact became Unitarian, many of them united with the Muslims rather easily when the Turkish Muslims came in and conquered this territory. But during this time, some of these people were sound in their beliefs. One of the biggest proofs of that, and I'm glad, and I think the Lord gave us that for a reason. Before they were destroyed, Samuel Morland, the agent for Oliver Cromwell, was able to come back to England with a large number of documents that were supposedly written in the 1100s that were written in the ancient language of these people in the Piedmont Valleys. You can read some of those in Moreland's history and a number of other histories that we have. William Jones wrote a Baptist history, which is very good in two volumes. And I say it's very good because it's easier to read than a lot of the rest of them. And he doesn't give quite so many, as I recall, of the actual word-for-word translations of those documents, but he comments on them a good bit in a rather easy-to-understand language. But one of those, I think the one I like the best, there's a tract called The Antichrist, in which they say just about everything in condemnation that we would say about the papal religion. They also reveal some things about their beliefs as to whether baptism is essential to salvation or whether it's just a symbol of something that happens spiritually, which is what they believed. The best one, I believe, is a document called The Noble Lesson. It reveals two things to me. One, they were not Catholic, and two, they were not Calvinistic. And as far as I can tell, even though there's some questions because the documents don't go into much detail on things like, well, did they immerse people or did they pour water on them? Or it doesn't say much about that. And so you're left in question a lot of times as to what they did in that regard. But everything else just sounds real good. And one of the favorite things to throw up against the Baptists by both Catholics and Protestants, well, you don't know that these people immersed. Well, if they were that much of a stickler facing the death penalty for so many of the other Bible doctrines, it's a little bit difficult for me to think that they would read over that one so lightly. Don't you think that's pretty logical? So this 1200 AD was a terrible time. France did not become so solidly Catholic by accident. They drove their opposition out of there and they went elsewhere. I'm told also that these Hussite churches, and I can't remember what book I got this out of, that before Martin Luther was ever saved, at the time he was converted, if he was saved, and I think he probably was, even though he did some pretty bad things that you wouldn't think a saved man would do toward people who believed like we do, there were 200 Hussite churches, Protestant churches, already in the area of Germany where Martin Luther lived. Did he really begin the Reformation? If there were 200 Protestant churches already there when he got saved? Of course, he didn't recognize those. They were far more sound in principle than he was. And so, you know, he has the reputation in history of being the founder of the Protestant Reformation. Well, about the time of Luther, there was also a fellow down in the Switzerland area by the name of Zwingli that was just as influential in getting the Reformation started. So just not those two, but a whole bunch of these fellows come out of the woodwork, rebelling against the Catholic Church. Well, something must be going on here. I think there was an awful lot of sound doctrine bouncing around in the middle of Europe along about that time. And, you know, some fellow could just come through there as a salesman or something and say, have you ever thought about this? If a man was honest, that one directive toward the truth might change his whole future. And he would never think to tell anybody that man whose name he might not even remember was the one that planted the seed that changed him from his faith in this superstitious Catholicism. Why, we shouldn't expect all of this stuff to be traceable. You don't even know where all the influences came from that helped you to get saved. And you do know that they came through the truth. And you know that God used someone, even though you may not remember even who it was. Now, my faith is stronger than it's ever been in this succession doctrine. But it's because of the truth I know from the Scriptures that my faith is so strong. And I find these little gems that back up what I'm saying time and time again in history. But as far as finding the kind of solid evidence that I could prove to a skeptic that didn't want to believe it, I suppose that that'll never happen. David Benedict, one of our Baptist historians, he said this. He said he believed, he was a successionist, and all of those landmark fellows said, don't try to make a chain link succession out of this. And what do? We try to make a chain link succession out of it. They all told us not to do that, from Grays, Pendleton, Benedict, all of them. Now, they were smart men. They knew the history. They knew that you couldn't really do that. At least the evidence hadn't been found yet. And so Benedict said he believed that if all of the records were available, a very good succession could probably be made out. Well, all the records aren't available. In fact, very few of them are, because it's hard to keep records when you're on the run. It's dangerous to keep records when they might be used against you in a court of law. And whenever your opponents, when they do exterminate you from an area, burn all the books they can find that you've written, what records you did keep, few of them survive. I'm just glad that in the providence of God that he allowed those few documents that were brought back from the Piedmont Valley by Samuel Moreland to survive. And I think he did that for a reason, so that we could see exactly where it was that the true faith survived. Look at this. What this is 1300 A.D. You see, the 1200s were that awful period of extermination and scattering, and didn't quit there. But by the 1300 A.D., you see all these different colors? The Roman Catholic Church by this time had this whole of Europe, even up here in Greenland. They had it divided up into their dominions. You know, each one belonged to a certain dominion under certain priests and certain archbishops. And so it had become very difficult to find any place to hide. There's your X right there, and there's the proximate center of where they were in Bohemia, right in between is Switzerland, where a lot of the Reformation took place, Germany. All right, sometime later in the 1600s, the Muslims would push all the way up into here and were turned back about there in their attempt to conquer Europe from the east. And so from there in the 700s to there in the 1600s makes a pretty narrow sandwich, doesn't it? That's where the activity was going on regarding the Lord's true churches. Now I'm going over and over some of this, the points that I really would like for you to get. And Brother Binion, if I'm leaving something out, don't hesitate to speak up or make a note of it, because we don't want to do that, anything important at least. Okay, let's go on here just a little bit. Well, okay, now here's the picture I made reference to a little earlier, and I've done some scratching on this map myself. By this time, the domain of the Holy Roman Empire was here, down around the Vatican, parts of Italy, and what's now all of Germany and a good bit more, Austria. Okay, now they have got the both of these centers and everything in between included within the Roman Empire, Holy Roman Empire. This is not good. But the year is 1559, and a number of things have happened by this time. We don't really know by this late date what became of the Waldenses that were in Bohemia. I think I know, but maybe some of the remnants were still there. We do know that they were still situated in these valleys in northern Italy. Actually, this region for a long, long time was a region called Savoy, and it was ruled by some dukes, and they were very hesitant to persecute these people. And it wasn't until the 1600s that they actually did really begin to persecute them. In 1532, a man named Guillaume Farel, that was a part of the Swiss Reform movement, went up into these valleys and persuaded the majority of these people to unite with the Swiss German, well, the Swiss Reformation. There was a minority that didn't agree with that. They didn't think that the for some reason that the Reformation was as sound as it ought to be, I guess. Most of them said, well, you know, it's a godsend. God has finally turned a bunch of these people away from the ignorance of Catholicism. They have thrown out five of the seven sacraments, and they only have two now, and they have preaching every Lord's Day instead of these masses and all of this. And the Reformation was really a very remarkable thing, because in just a few years, Zwingli and Calvin and Luther, they actually went into what had been Catholic churches by the hundreds and took them over and threw all that stuff out and turned them into churches that I'm going to say were a lot sounder in the biblical sense than what they had ever been. Of course, this caused a lot of warfare and a lot of fury, and had the popes and their followers been able, they would have no doubt burned Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and all their buddies alive at the stake, just like they did Huss and Jerome, and just like they did poor old William Tyndale, who committed the horrid crime of translating the Bible into readable English. They caught him in Holland in 1536, burned him alive. That's not so long ago. Now, whenever these infidels in the colleges today and various other places start throwing it in your face that Christians persecuted Galileo for believing that the earth revolved around the sun, Catholics did that. In fact, they made him recant that, his Copernican theory. Wasn't that awful? And they'll try to tell you, Bible-believing Christians, you did that to Galileo. No, we didn't. The people who did that outlawed the Bible. And those same people that persecuted Galileo burned William Tyndale alive. It's a lot worse than what they did to Galileo for translating the Bible into the English language. That was 1536. The Bible had been translated to English by Wycliffe in the 1300s, but the language had changed so much in those 200 years that if you had a Wycliffe Bible, you couldn't read it. If you had a Tyndale Bible, you could probably stumble through it today. It's not much different than King James Version, which in its origin would be a little bit difficult for you to read too if you had one of the originals. But the language hasn't changed much. The English language hasn't changed much in the last 350 years compared to what it changed from 1300s to the 1500s. So William Tyndale was quite a fellow. He was an Englishman or a Welshman, and he fled to Holland, and there they caught him and ended his life at a very young age. So I don't know where I was there in talking about the Protestants, but you can take all of that for what it's worth. And I've got some, not only got the two X's, and by the way, I found out that if you will take a straight edge and go to the top of this sea here between Italy and the Balkans, and go with a straight line over to where Spain and France meet, the bend there, take another line from Carthage right here in this little harbor, right up through the middle of the top of the Isle of Sardinia, and every time it will locate those people for you. Now, I had to study that a good while to figure out how I could do that on a map that did not have, well, that had borders shifting all the time. And I would have you to notice that Italy is still not a country. It's just an area that's made up of large numbers of countries. You think that the Italians are all somewhat dark-complected and brown eyes. You ever meet up with any blonde-haired, blue-eyed Italians? Well, there are some. That's because northern Italy, many years before, the Germans took a large section of northern Italy and settled in there and stayed and became Italians. Lombards, the region is called Lombardy now. And so not all Italians are have a dark complexion and brown eyes and dark hair for that reason. The Germans had quite an influence on them. Now, I said in 1532, what was left of the Waldenses in that those precious valleys where they existed for 1,000 years joined the Reformation. The Reformation practiced infant baptism, infant sprinkling, in fact. The Reformation, like the Presbyterians and Lutherans and such like to this day, the group they joined was actually would be Presbyterians, the closest thing to them, the Calvinists. Would we recognize them after they joined that group? The answer is no, and I don't think we should. But that was 1532, and I don't know what these up here in Bohemia did, whether they did that right then or whether they ever did it. But along about the same time, some people will tell you that here in Switzerland, there was a Catholic priest named Conrad Grebel that got saved and changed from his Catholicism and became an Anabaptist and founded the Anabaptist. Well, some of your Mennonites who are direct descendants of them today will buy into that story. They'll say, yes, we began with Conrad Grebel. No, they didn't. There's other Mennonites that vehemently deny that. The Mennonites are descended from the Waldenses. In fact, they're essentially the same people. Maybe a little more outgoing, a little more evangelistic, and a little more willing to have their heads cut off than to run and hide. By this time, by 1532, there was a bunch of them here. and over here in Austria, and all the way up here in Holland. Where'd it come from? Greville didn't start them all. They got there too fast. Well, there's a number of historians, and I think Gerald is one of them. Baptist Perpetuity by W.A. Gerald is one of the best that I have found to make this concise. G.H. Orchard has a history that's very extensive on this same period, that from the beginning down to the Reformation. But Orchard says he includes a lot of people, infers that they're Baptists that I don't think were. I think a goodly many of these people under each of these names, whether they be Novatians, Donatists, Paulicians, and all these other names you read in the Trail of Blood, a good many of these people were never what we would call Baptists. That's my opinion. They would more likely be called Protestants. But somewhere on the fringes of these movements, in most cases, no doubt there were some sound churches. And there are some of these groups that appear to me to be right on the target. for example, in the 1100s here in parts of southern France, a group that were called Petrobrusians. And I can't really find anything from what evidence we have of their beliefs that you could find wrong with these people. So in some cases, a given name, most of those folks might have been sound. And here's something else too. They might have been sound today and 100 years later not sound. Do you know any Baptists like that? No. They're all over the country. There are periods whenever that churches are really sound and valiant for the truth, and 100 years down the road, we're talking about hundreds of years, that same group under that same name is no longer even close to sound. And so you have to keep that in mind when you're reading this history. If you just accept the Trail of Blood, you'll probably be spouting things to people that they know is not right. It's a good place to start, and I recommend it as one of the first things you'd read. It will really excite you and get you interested. But you may run onto people that say, well, no, the Novatians weren't Baptist, and they very likely are right. They were Baptist in the sense that they immersed, because everybody did back then. But would we recognize them as sound churches? I seriously doubt it. But there's not much way to find out because we don't have any documents. But now these Anabaptists, we have a lot of testimony what they believe. There's a book that's, I think it's about 1,200 pages, called Martyr's Mirror, that was written by a Mennonite fellow back in the 1600s, I believe. And most of what he recorded happened in the 1500s, right about that time when the Waldensian people, the last remnants of them, united the Reformation, and the Anabaptists suddenly appeared all over Europe. What did they believe? Well, I'll tell you, there never was a people persecuted worse than they were. I read of a man named Jacob de Roer that was interviewed in a jail cell by a Catholic priest, and he interpreted the third chapter of John exactly the way I do for that priest about the new birth. I believe just exactly what we do. These people, their documents emphasize the spiritual life of the new birth, the inward holiness that you must have so strongly, there is no doubt. And yet there are some people who will say, well, you know, we don't know whether they immersed their descendants, the Mennonites and the Amish, and they are their descendants of a little group here in Switzerland. But you see, that was just a small portion of them. They all pour for baptism. Besides that, they believe you can be saved today and lost tomorrow. Even though for many years, and even still, many of them do know what it is to be saved. There was a big, big, big group of Anabaptists in Holland. Not in the mountains, but in the Netherlands, the lowlands. In the 1600s, in the 1500s, which is the period we're looking at, Spain, see the coloration on Spain here, for some reason had the Netherlands in their dominion. Now let's back up on Spain just a minute. You remember that Alfonso, the king of Aragon, which is this portion of Spain, Spain wasn't one whole country until about 1492 and thereafter. Alfonso had forfeited his life fighting for our ancestors. And not too many years later, in the 1400s, Ferdinand, the king of Aragon, married the queen of Castile, Isabella. And they united northern Spain into one country. They mobilized their armies and they drove these saber-wielding Moors that had ruled the country for 700 years back into Africa. Now Spain was finally Christian once again. A lot of the bloodlines of the Spanish people, whether they want to admit it or not, are African or Arab. But Spain is Catholic today because they started an Inquisition to rid the land of all but Catholics. You could either convert, leave, or die. And this couple was determined to convert the world to Catholicism. Well, there was a Genoan Italian from Genoa sea captain named Christopher Columbus, or Cristobal Colon, I believe is the way that they pronounce it over there. We call him Christopher Columbus. Appealed to them to finance him to do something he'd been wanting to do for a long while. For the glory of God, Columbus was a very devout Catholic, and the conversion of the heathen, he wanted to go west and find a route to the east. And they financed him, and the rest is history. As they say, we know what happened. Columbus discovered a hemisphere that the Europeans therefore didn't know anything about. And it came to be a refuge for us. The very people that were the most zealous to destroy us, that is descending Christians from the Catholic faith, were the people who authorized a man to go find us a refuge. This is the kind of irony that God loves to work out. And that is a real jewel to me when I found that one. Now, Columbus, I don't think, really did think that he was likely to fall off the edge of the ocean out there. Flatlanderism was not near as strong as the infidels today would have us to believe it was. I understand he had intelligence from the Vikings that they had found land by sailing across the Atlantic Ocean. And I think that that's probably true. You can tell from his writings that he was no dummy, as they say. And you can read a number of things that Christopher Columbus wrote to this day. By the way, those hardened Spaniards had been used to fighting the Moors and the Arabs. And, you know, they were, whether they wanted to admit it or not, some of them were part of the same bloodline. They were a very rugged, cruel people at that point in time. But what they found in the Caribbean made them cringe. The Carib Indians herded the Arawaks and cultivated them like cattle and ate them. Oh yes, that's where the word cannibal came from the word that they had for these people. This so enraged these Spaniards that naturally they wanted to wipe them out. When they got over to the coast of Mexico, they found the Aztecs and their glorious civilization, where human sacrifice, again, just was so prevalent that it offended the Spaniards. And they didn't really have any doubt about the fact that it was their Catholic destiny to conquer these people and put an end to all that. And most of the other tribes that had been so persecuted by the Caribs and the Aztecs were very willing to be delivered by the Spaniards. So that's just a little bit of American history that's very politically incorrect today. And if you want to prove it to yourself, just read some of the accounts that were written by the men who sailed with Christopher Columbus in his four voyages, and they will tell you how horrified they were at some of the awful practices that were going on in the New World when they got here. And that's not saying nothing to justify the way they were. Now, back to the church history for just a moment. Now, I think I'm about to run out of time here. And I don't want to weary you too much. I don't have that book. I have it loaned to Brother Derek. Don't have it with me, but I don't need it anyway. It is a very good book, Baptist Confessions of Faith by W.L. Lumpkin. And in there, it tells us that by this period and before, there had been tens of thousands of Dutch Anabaptists who had fled to England to escape Spanish persecution. And during the period of Alva, which was 1560 to 1580, the Duke of Alva was sent there to exterminate religion that wasn't Catholic. Of course, he didn't get that done. A few years later, the northern part of the Netherlands, which is Netherlands today, became Protestant and won their independence from Spain, while the southern part, which is Belgium today, remained Catholic. Okay, so during Alva's time, Lumpkin says that there were as many as 100,000 refugees that fled to England. You see, for the most part, these people wouldn't fight. They took literally what the Lord said, when they persecute you in one city, flee to another. Now, when they got to England, they encountered monarchs like Elizabeth and James, who were Protestant. And you say, well, that's pretty good. Well, it wasn't too good, because it was still a death penalty to be convicted of practicing rebaptism, which is what they did when someone got saved that was a member of the Church of England that had been sprinkled in infancy before they were ever saved. When they baptized them to bring them into their fellowship, that was considered a major heresy, and the penalty was death. So there were a number of people, even in England, though it wasn't as severe as it was on the continent, who were put to death for being Anabaptist in the 1500s. So it wasn't too good climate for them either, but it was a whole lot better than being under Spanish dominions. These people never went home. Now, this was 1560 to 1580. They became Englishmen. The first Baptist appeared in the early 1600s, under that name, that is, in England, and they were General Atonement Baptists. Don't confuse that with General Baptist. They believed that Christ died for all men. And they appeared in the very regions where the Anabaptists had settled 50 or so years before, in great numbers. It doesn't take a genius to figure out what happened. Two of the things that both groups strongly emphasized, and we know that they did from the records, is freedom of conscience. What do you think about this? Freedom of conscience and the equality of all men. That's very American, isn't it? But it didn't get that way by accident. You see, the Lord imposed that concept on this whole nation providentially. And our Brother Binion 1 will get into that and show you how that happened later, hopefully. But that was a very novel idea. Even to this day, England, I've heard it said some time ago, when the last monarch had disappeared from the face of the earth, England will still have a king. You see, class distinction still very strong over there, even if it's not in the political realm, in the social realm. That's been eliminated in this country. Baptist doctrine had the biggest hand in doing that. In other words, this is Anglo-American culture, English-American culture, that we've all adopted regardless of where we come from. But there are some things that we've adopted that are very non-English, and that's one of them. But these people appeared over there at a time when all England was Calvinistic. Even the Church of England had a Calvinistic creed. What's Calvinism? Predestination. The only group in the early 1600s in England that I know of that weren't predestinarian were those General Atonement Baptists. Where did they come from? Well, the Dutch Anabaptists are notoriously Arminian or non-Calvinistic in history. We know that. It's obvious where they came from. Now, you'll read in history about one John Smith that was independent, and he got disillusioned with the Church of England, and he took a group of followers and he went over to Holland, and there he baptized himself. I don't know whether that means he, one of his congregation baptized him, or whether he went out there in the water and just ducked himself under. Gerald disputes that, says John Smith was baptized in England before he went over there. Now, whether that's true, I don't know, but the people who don't want to believe there are any Baptists in England certainly couldn't believe that. But regardless, he started a congregation and took them to Holland, or had a congregation, took them to Holland. And after he had gotten this congregation, which wasn't Baptist, supposedly when they went there, baptized after a fashion, he decided that he made a mistake, that he should have gone to his neighboring Mennonites or Anabaptists and gotten their baptism, because they'd had it for hundreds of years. And finally, that's what he did. He and his whole congregation, except for a few. Thomas Helwys and a few dissenters said, no, we're satisfied with this baptism. We're not going to go and join up with the Mennonites. Now keep in mind, we're talking about Mennonites way back there in Holland, not in Switzerland, where most of them in this country come from, or German Switzerland. So Helwys went back and somewhere around 1610 started a congregation or a church with those few people in London. They said, aha, that's the first English Baptist church. I don't believe a word of it. It's just the one that made the pages of history, because they can argue that it started with a man who baptized himself. Well, I've got a notion that the other General Baptists took Helwys' congregation into their fellowship and went right on. Some of our sticklers today might not like that very well, but I believe that to be true. But nevertheless, there were too many of them for them all to have started from that one man. Now, somewhere around the 1630s, there were a lot of separatists. We sort of know what they were. I believe the Pilgrims were that when they came to Holland and then went on to America and settled at Plymouth Rock. They had decided the Church of England was hopeless and they were going to separate from it instead of try to stay in it and reform it. Many of these separatists begin to take one step further. They begin to see that they didn't have the right kind of baptism. They needed to be Baptist. One of those congregations, and you see these people were Calvinistic. I believe this was in the 1630s. It might have been on into the 40s. I've lost my date precisely. But there was a church in London that decided they needed to be Baptist. And a goodly portion of those people thought, well, you know, we really just shouldn't start baptizing out of the clear blue. We have heard that there's a group of Anabaptists in Holland called the Collegians. We have Richard Blunt here, one of our preachers, and he speaks Dutch. Let's send Richard to Holland. You'll find this in Crosby's history, and a lot of them since then. Crosby was one of the oldest English Baptist histories, if not the oldest. Let's send Richard Blunt to England, or rather to Holland, and he can get baptism from the Collegiate Anabaptist and come back and bring it to us. So he got baptism and he came back to London and he baptized a man by the name of Samuel Blacklock and a part of two congregations, if I remember correctly, though Blacklock was also a preacher. The two of them baptized a goodly part of two congregations, and the first Calvinistic Baptist church on the face of this earth was started in London at that point. I find that very interesting. That was the branch that initially came to this country in great numbers. However, they didn't hang on to their Calvinism very strongly for very long. That's another story that we're not going to get into a great deal. In the 1640s, and here's another jewel I ran onto not very long ago. In the Baptist Church in Newport, Rhode Island, where John Clark was the pastor, argued very well by many that it was the first and the oldest Baptist church on this continent. In Newport, Rhode Island, in the 1640s, there appeared a preacher by the name of Mark Luker, usually spelled L-U-C-A-R. Mark Luker was one of the brothers that was baptized by Richard Blunt when he came back from Holland with the Collegiate Anabaptist baptism. I don't know how much influence Mark Luker had in the church in Newport, Rhode Island, but I do know that he was one of their preachers and he was received into their fellowship. Now, brethren, we'll get on later to tell you just how much influence the Rhode Island Baptist had on the separate Baptist, which are the ones that exploded over the mountains and graced this part of the country a century or so later. The Rhode Island Baptist is the one who gave them their baptism. That's getting all up into this country and what happened here. But I did want you to see that very strong connection, and Gerald, W.A. Gerald, does a beautiful job in Baptist Church Perpetuity of drawing that linkage between the Anabaptist in Holland and the Baptist in England. And there's no question but what they came to these shores from the English Baptist. Now, there's one thing that Gerald mentions that I do want to also give you. He said at one period of time there were numerous people, or a number of people, I don't remember how many he said now, who were members of the Anabaptist churches in the lowlands of the Netherlands who had Italian names. Isn't that a gem? Why would they have Italian names? Because they came there from the valleys of Italy. Isn't that an awful strong indication that Waldensian people became Anabaptist? They didn't just disappear all at once. They didn't all join the Reformation. When the center and the heart of them joined the Reformation, God had already passed the torch to somebody else who would carry it more valiantly. I suppose the Waldensian people were tired by that time. I mean, they'd carried it for 1,000 years. Done a wonderful job, preserved it through the ages. Now it was time for a revival. Need somebody a little more aggressive. And the Anabaptists fit that bill. They swarmed all over here. And I believe the Baptists would do even better because they would carry it not only to the New World and conquer it, but to the othermost parts of the earth. I look forward to next week. God bless you.